The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Morris Williams, and it is my great pleasure to welcome all of you to the Free Library of Philadelphia for another wonderful Free Library lecture. I'd like to ask you to help the Free Library of Philadelphia. I can think of two ways that you can help. One is to make a contribution to support the activities of a library, particularly direct them. I would encourage you toward the branches and the after-school activities that are so important in serving the needs of our young people, who I think have suffered the most as a result of the past several years of COVID. But the second is that it's political season, and many of you may be going to meetings with candidates, both for the mayor and for city council. And I would urge you to ask them, tell them about the importance of the Free Library and how important it is that city council and the mayor increase funding for the Free Library so it can be available to serve the needs of this great city of Philadelphia. Meanwhile, we have a wonderful speaker in Simon Winchester tonight. A couple of things in addition to the material you've received already about him that I thought you might find of interest. I think the most interesting is the fact that he was 54 years old and had served as a journalist all over the world in various places all over the globe, including spending 3 months in jail being arrested during the midst of a war, which you may want to ask him about. But he was in China and came upon the idea of a thought that led to his first book in 1998, The Professor and the Madman. And that book has now sold millions of copies. And this fall, he tells me, they're going to come out a 25-year anniversary edition because it is still popular and still being well-received, as it should be, because it's a fascinating story. I want to read you just one short quote from his book, which I think is insightful and maybe sets a little bit of a theme which you will expand in terms of the Q&A with Mr. Winchester. But quoting him, "If the electronic computer is swiftly becoming so much more powerful and more able than even the most prodigiously able of all human brains, then what is the likely outcome for that very human society that has been the principal beneficiary of human intelligence for all of the world's inhabited existence? If our brains, if we, that is, for our brains are the permanent essence of us, no longer have need of knowledge, and if we no longer have need because computers can do it all for us, then what is human intelligence good for? An existential intellectual crisis looms. If machines will acquire all of our knowledge for us and do all our thinking for us, then what, pray tell, is the need for us to be?" Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Philadelphia welcome to Simon Winchester and his wonderful book, Knowing What We Know.
Thank you, Maurice, very much indeed, and a big hand to you for your support. I think this is the third talk of mine that I think the Pacific and the one on precision, I think in England it was called exactly, in America it was called The Perfectionists. So thank you again. This is just great. I should say to you all, and thank you very much indeed for coming, that the book was actually launched yesterday. So I was talking in Cambridge, Mass, and early days, you're never quite sure whether you've got the length of the speech right or not. So I am going to set a timer. And I tried to get it to sort of merely buzz, but I couldn't yesterday. And so Thank God it didn't play the music to which I wake up each morning. That would have been horribly embarrassing, but it will sound a bell. So I'm going to set it for 35 minutes, and it did go off yesterday, because I do have this habit of rather going on a bit, I'm afraid. So this book was born really during the pandemic, after the previous book I wrote, which was a book about land ownership. And someone said to me, to what extent did you use Google and Wikipedia when you were doing the book? And I said, you know, quite a lot. What did I think the use of it was doing to our brains, or my brain? And I thought it was a legitimate question. And I thought, therefore, and I had just been reading that famous T.S. Eliot play, it was called The Rock, and there is this line in it, or these three lines, which, what is this life we have lost in living? What is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? What is the knowledge we have lost in information? And those three lines, particularly the middle one about the wisdom that we have lost in knowledge, because there's so much knowledge, do we even have time to think about being wise, seem to be a legitimate thing to think about, particularly now with all the technological advances that I'll get to towards the end of these 34 minutes. So I put the proposal to my editor, and she very kindly said, yes, let's go ahead. So initially a daunting topic. I mean, how on earth do you write a book about knowledge? And so it had to be organized fairly economically to just manage to corral it all into whatever it is, for 400 pages. So how do you transmit knowledge? Well, first of all, I suppose you have to ask yourself, what is knowledge? And what I desperately didn't want to do was to make this a book that has the word epistemology more than once in the book, because it's such a horrible word, even though it is the Greek word for knowledge. And it renders the subject into something really dull and academic and tedious, because there are so many different types of knowledge: knowledge how, knowledge why, knowledge what, knowledge who. So I tried to keep away from that, but nonetheless, I did want to try and make the point, the difference between what is known in the profession as the DIKW pyramid: data, information, knowledge, and wisdom. And just, I mean, what is the difference between those two things? Well, let's not look too deeply, but data, I mean, what's the data about Philadelphia population? What, 1.6 million, 106 square miles, average height, I don't know, 74 feet or something like that. That's the data. And the information you can get, it's on the Schuylkill River, it lies at the foothills of these mountains, it's in this county where the people, you know, William Penn and all the rest of it. That's information. If you cook that information, if you get to know it even more, even better, and you know your way to walk from, I don't know, Rittenhouse Square, where I'm staying, over to the library, then you can sort of legitimately say you've acquired knowledge. It's interesting, is it not, that, and I don't know if any of you will have seen the film called The Knowledge, which is about London taxi drivers. You may see these young men, usually on small motorcycles in London, with clipboards in front of them, learning every single potential run through London, because they're unerring. They don't use GPS at all in London taxis, but they manage to get from A to B in the most efficient and effective way, because they have, and it takes years to acquire it, the knowledge. Knowledge is information cooked, if you like. That's an easy way of putting it, and London taxi drivers have it more than most, at least more than most taxi drivers I've come across, particularly in New York. So definition, though. Let's deal with the definition, because it involves the Greeks, and it was Plato talking in one of the Platonic dialogues to Socrates, of course, about what is knowledge. And he defined it in a way that, well, what is that, 500 BC, so 3,000 years ago. And although epistemologists have revised it innumerable times, it's still basically what Plato said. And that's justified true belief. And very simply, explicably, I can explain it by saying, this is a podium. Now, I can declare it to be a podium, and it might just as well be a table or a book or a holiday in Spain or who knows what. I'm going to say it's a podium, but that's not enough, according to Plato. If I can then say I honestly and truthfully, deep in my heart, believe this to be a podium, then I've ticked two of the boxes. It's an honestly believed to be a podium. But still that's not good enough, according to Plato. You need to justify that belief. And so you provide illustrations of other podiums. You produce a definition from an encyclopedia or whatever. And only when your true belief is justified can you legitimately say that this is a piece of knowledge. This is a podium, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a lie. It's what I believe it to be. And here's the justification. So sort of bear that in mind, but don't bear it in mind quite as much as that second of the T.S. Eliot axioms about where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge, because that's important, I think. So, knowledge, how do you then distribute it? And that's what the book is about, because I'm trying to answer the question, is the way in which, in various sectors of life, knowledge has been transmitted, is it somehow affecting, for good or for ill, our brains? And is it possibly leading us not to think as we might think, and possibly not displaying the wisdom that human society, I believe, needs? So I've divided the book then, once having defined it, and my own personal first memory I have of acquiring any knowledge, I remember it vividly, I'll never forget it, 2 years and I think 7 months old, it was in 1947, I think, when after a shopping trip, I put my foot in my Wellington boot, it was summer, and so I'd left the boots on the steps of the house, and I put my left, what I later came to realize was my left foot, into my left boot, and was stung by a wasp. So all of a sudden I knew, I came to know within the next 5 minutes, that a wasp stung, and a wasp was different from a bee, because my mother said, had it been a bee, you would have had the last laugh, because the bee would have died, whereas the wasp goes on to do it again. That ice and calamine lotion can soothe the swelling, that you win sympathy if you're stung, so it's not altogether a bad thing. And also that was my left foot at that stage. I had no idea the difference between left and right. Now I did and will always remember it. But generally, how is knowledge passed on? I mean, it can be brought about by experience, but how do you pass it on? And so the first chapter is essentially about teaching. But in order to teach, generally speaking, not exclusively, it's useful to have written material. So before there was writing, how did people transmit knowledge? And they did it orally. And a very good example came about in 2004, the 26th of December, what in England we call Boxing Day, but otherwise it's merely the 26th of December, where was that enormous submarine earthquake off the north coast of Sumatra, leading into this gigantic tsunami, which killed 250,000 people, probably the most titanic event that any of us will know in our various lifetimes. On the Andaman Islands, which are a north-south chain of islands in the Bay of Bengal, some distance away from the Indian mainland, relatively close to Burma, there are a number of people, I mean many thousands of people living. In the very north of the islands, there are three essentially uncontacted groups of people, the Jarawa, the Sentinelese, and the Andamanese, I think they are. Anyway, the rest of them are Hindus, mainly migrants from the Indian subcontinent. The Jarawa have no written language, but they have a powerful language of song, much like the Aboriginals in Australia, which they use from time to time, and they teach their youngsters, and the youngsters in turn teach their youngsters. And so they've existed for thousands of years. And on this particular morning, Jarawa were out mending their nets or dealing with their boats to go out for a day's fishing, and they saw something completely unexpected, which was the seas disappearing, leaving the sand dry for about a mile in front of them. They'd never seen it before. But they suddenly realized, the elders in this group on the beach, that there was a song about that. If the sea ever does go out, then run for the hills. And they shouted to each other, run. No one quite knew why. And they all, as one, ran up into the jungle hills, 300 or 400 feet up, and watched with horror as this gigantic series of waves rushed in and all the people to the south of them who were Hindus from India and had a perfectly well and long established written tradition died. Whereas none of them, not a single Jarawa or Sentinelese, died because an oral tradition, the transmission of knowledge orally, had saved them. So there are a few examples of that kind of transmission of knowledge in indigenous peoples dotted around the world. But most of this book has to be necessarily concerned with written knowledge. And where does that all begin? And the answer, I had thought it probably would be in China, but it turns out not to be. The earliest writing, as probably many of us actually do know if you think about it, is cuneiform writing from Mesopotamia. And the earliest school that we so far know to have existed is in a little place south of Baghdad called Nippur. And that was excavated in the 1870s by a group largely of British archaeologists. And they found what is in effect the first schoolhouse. And there's a sort of rather charming aspect to it on two levels. First of all, you find these tablets of what once was relatively soft clay from the clays of which most of Mesopotamia is composed because of flooding of the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. And the children that were being taught would inscribe using sharpened reeds their cuneiform symbols. And on those occasions when the child did not get whatever he was being instructed about right, it would either be crossed out, and you would find tablets with crossings out and an attempt to write it more accurately beneath it, or the teacher would, or the child, would smash the tablet and throw the material away into a big box in the middle of the schoolroom, just by an oven that was used for baking bread to feed the children and keep them warm in the wintertime. And the charming aspect of this, not only was knowledge being transmitted to them by this arcane method at the very beginning of the history of writing, but also it was done sustainably, because it was evident from the archaeological research that at the end of each school day, one child was instructed to pick up this box of broken tablets and take them down to the Euphrates, and I think it was the Euphrates rather than Tigris, put water into this essentially large square bucket, and using his hands, squeeze the shards back into clay once again, form it into a big ball, and then press out new tablets, usually about 6 inches by 9 inches, and put them on top of the bread oven, where by the following morning they have turned into almost hard, but not that hard that they can't be written on for another day. In other words, not only was it educational, but it was sustainable as well. They used the same material day after day. So sustainability, all the rage today, was very much a big thing in Mesopotamia, 3,500 years before the Common Era. That's what, nearly 6,000 years ago. So the transmission of knowledge, therefore, began in a formal sense from elders to younger people a long, long time ago. So I devote the first chapter of the book to this, the whole phenomenon of teaching knowledge. And I look at, you know, all over the world. I begin actually in a school that I know very well in Bangalore in South India, because I used to live in India for quite a long time. And then I take it up to date through a variety of schooling systems around the world to modern times. And I talk about examinations and the nature of testing, therefore, at the end of your school life, what you have learned, what knowledge has been inculcated during your 10 or so years at school. And I look at the SAT here, and believe you me, if I'm at all critical of America, I do so now as an American, not some sort of pompous Englishman coming in and tell you how to organize yourselves. But I became a citizen in 2011, so I have sort of a right to be a little bit disturbed at the SAT. I probably couldn't do it, but on the other hand, multiple choice questions at least gives you a 25% chance of... and I think the essay, the culminating essay, is so much more a test of your ability to think. As an example of, and I'm going to get on to a Chinese essay in a moment, but reminiscing personally, I mean, I went to Oxford in 1963, and I took my exams to get in 62, and I took them in Pembroke College. There were only two of us, and I remember vividly sitting under this enormous oil painting of an alumnus of the college, Samuel Johnson, and being therefore incredibly intimidated that I had this great mind sort of gazing down at me. And the invigilator said, "Gentlemen, take your desks." And the college clock struck 9, and you had 3 hours. He said, "Then turn your papers over." And there were 5 questions, 5 essays to do. Choose 2 of them and write an essay on each for an hour and a half. And I don't know, the other chap was called Chris Talbot, who went on to become head of the British Customs Service, oddly enough. So we weren't very good friends as a result. But the two I chose from the 5 were 2 cheers for democracy, is 2 the right number? Which I thought was a wonderful question for a 17-year-old child. And is the American way of life truly exportable? Which also seemed to be a fascinating subject. So I really enjoyed doing it. And at the end, 3 hours are up, gentlemen, turn your papers over and stop writing. And that was it. And I got in. So obviously they thought I had, to an extent anyway, learned to think to a certain extent. Well, the Chinese have had this very formal examination system now for getting on for 1,800 years. Nowadays, it's called the Gaokao, which essentially means the end of school exam. And it's an enormous event. It takes place in June. All children take it when they're 17. And it determines, really, for the rest of your life. In the early days, it was to determine whether you'd get into the Chinese civil service, whether you would become a Mandarin. And it was an attempt by the same emperor who built the Great Wall of China to create what was essentially the first meritocracy, to say it's nothing to do with privilege, this is all to do with whether you're clever enough to run the country. And so the exams have always been legendarily difficult, challenging, interesting, and the 2003 Gaokao, which lasts for about 3 days, taken the essays from the paper that was set, and I rather like one of these. The containers for milk are always square boxes. Containers for mineral water are always round bottles, and round wine bottles are usually placed in square boxes. Write an essay on the subtle philosophy of the round and the square. I mean, what fun. No wonder they're doing so well in China. I sort of said rather unkindly that the difference between the Chinese and the American SAT is the difference between go and go fish. So I talk about education and how that discrete field, as it advances or changes, what that does to our brains. Does it improve them? Are our brains necessarily better trained, better filled with knowledge than they were, let's say, in the 17th or 18th centuries? So then I move from that topic onto the storing of information, the storage of information. Obviously in libraries, and couldn't be a better place to talk about it, but on the other hand, I only have 16 minutes and 29 seconds to do so. So I better move along. But obviously the first famous library is Alexandria in Greek Egypt. And I look at a variety of libraries around the world, New York Public Library, the London Library. If any of you have been to the London Library, and I don't mean the British Museum or indeed the British Library, but the London Library, which is Thomas Carlyle's old library from the 19th century, transformed now into the most eccentric, weird, but wonderful private library in St. James's Square. It's about £500 a year, well worth joining, because it's a place, if you read in the book, that it encourages serendipity. One of the most bizarre libraries is built in the late 19th century by a couple of Belgians. One of them, I was going to say Belgian lunatics, but one clearly wasn't a lunatic because he went on to win the Nobel Prize for chemistry, I think. But they decided that they would collect all the knowledge in the world and put it on filing 3x5 cards and store them in oak filing cabinets. And so increasingly, it grew exponentially. And at its heyday, it was about 2 million filing cabinets. If you can imagine, if you remember the filing cabinets here, they were pretty big, but this is all the knowledge in the world, and they developed a classification system, the universal decimal classification system, which is still used by some people in the world. There's a whole chapter about classification systems because Melville Dewey, who made the most famous one, is being so rapidly discarded by librarians today because he was such an awful human being. I mean, he makes Mr. Weinstein look an angel by comparison. So if you see Dewey Decimal, have nothing to do with it. So I then move on from actual physical libraries into, inevitably, the subject that brought me to this book in the first place, which was the assembly of Wikipedia, and the whole question of whether you trust it. And I think this question of whether you trust the information that is passed on to you was very cogent in the early days of Jimmy Wales's Wikipedia. People didn't trust it. But as the hive mind has got bigger and bigger and bigger, we do rather more, and rather more, I might say, than we trust or should have trusted the big Britannic, the big encyclopedias, beginning with Descartes' Encyclopédie in French in the mid-18th century. But now the Britannica in the English language was for many years, of course, the paramount encyclopedia, but was so often horribly, horribly wrong. And the 11th edition, which was, 1923 until 1955, I think it was, some of the entries were too offensive for this book. I mean, the entry on a very long entry, about 8 pages, on the Negro, and forgive me, that was what it was called, the first page of that was so utterly offensive that my editor said, this cannot appear in the book. So I allude to it, but I don't actually repeat what was said. So there was quite a lot of information in the Britannica. In its heyday, it was, 32 volumes. Cost a great deal of money, although when it was peddled by Sears Roebuck, you could get it for $1 a week or something. But you'd sort of in retrospect anyway, you shouldn't have trusted it. But should you trust Wikipedia? And as a matter of comparison, at its apotheosis, or rather its apogee, Britannica had 40,000 discrete essays. Wikipedia, as of yesterday, 7.5 million. So a great deal of knowledge. And remember also Karl Popper's remark that knowledge is finite, but ignorance is infinite. There's far more that we don't know that even the 7 million of Wikipedia is trivial. Do we trust that? Well, oddly enough, I generally do, but there came an event. I was writing about hypertext, which is a very important for electronics. It was invented by a fellow called Doug Engelbart at a thing called the Mother of All Demos in San Francisco in the late 1960s. Hypertext, hugely important in searching for information. So I'm writing about Engelbart and the Mother of All Demos, and then I think, well, I better get some biographical information. Where was he born? All the rest of it. And it said he died on the very day I was writing. It was March the 10th last year. And I thought, well, that's a droll coincidence. How awful. I mean, to write about someone and he dies on the day I'm writing about him, that is, I better be very careful about it. Elder. But I looked for obituaries and there was nothing in the New York Times. There was nothing in Wired. I looked in the sort of electronic publications because he was a hugely important, although generally rather forgotten figure, and nothing. So I posted a question on Twitter saying, did anyone realize that this titanic figure, Doug Engelbart, had died today? And how awful. And overnight, I went to bed, went to sleep. And in the morning, there was a note from a chap in New Zealand who was a Wikipedia editor. And he had said he didn't die at all. Some hacker in Australia killed off at random 10 people that day, including a baseball star, a motor racing chap in Japan, a boxer, 2 Australian politicians, and Doug Engelbart. He's fine and kicking, and I think he still is today. So we shouldn't totally even trust Wikipedia today. So there's another item of... We wonder whether this means of distributing knowledge is actually good for the human brain. So then I get onto the whole question of the printing press, the invention of paper by Chinese, printing press also by the Chinese, although generally thought to be Gutenberg in the 15th century. In fact, the oldest printed document in the world is not something like the Gutenberg Bible, but is a Tibetan text printed with wooden block, movable type, in 867 AD, so 600 years before Caxton and Gutenberg, who were, of course, reckoned to be the principals in this business. Well, that led to, well, all sorts of things, the distribution of, after all, probably the initial truly important printed document, leaving aside the Gutenberg Bible, was the tract by Martin Luther, nailed to the church in Wittenberg, printed, he printed 60 copies, I think, arguing against the whole practice of indulgences in the Roman Church, and thereby bringing about the enormous schism in the church, which lingers today. I mean, I spent 3 years in Northern Ireland, so I came to know that schism rather well. So how the effect that printing has had on the world, and then that leads you into newspapers. And newspapers originally, of course, were essentially to provide information, naked information, like the arrival of ships and so forth in ports. But then proprietors started to buy newspapers, and news became commodified, and certain news was made prominent, certain news less so. So you got this concept of newspapers of record, like the Times of London, which is no longer, but the New York Times sort of still is, but it's probably the only one, and becoming increasingly questionable. I'm not a great admirer, probably many of you are, of Tom Friedman, who I often think that Tom Friedman, the New York Times, if there was a Olympic sport for bloviating, he would win gold. But that's an impertinence, but it's an indication, I think, of the lack of trust, faith we have in newspapers. A classic example, and I really have to be careful of the time, is something called the Zinoviev letter, which we think today, the fake news and all of that is important. But believe you me, in 1924, the way that the Daily Mail brought down a government was pretty classic. What happened was there was a socialist prime minister called Ramsay MacDonald, first socialist ever in number 10 Downing Street. The old school conservatives loathed his presence there, did their best within parliament to get him out, and they forced a vote of no confidence. The majority was slender enough that he lost it, had to go back to the country for a new election. In England, remember, only a 3-week campaign. Merciful, my God, compared with what we're in for the next year and a half. But during that period, so it was Ramsay MacDonald on the left and Stanley Baldwin on the right, and 5 days before the election, a communication was received from Moscow, from the Secretary General of Comintern, the International Communist Party, a man called Zinoviev. And he wrote saying, "Comrades in England, if you do me the honour of voting for Ramsay MacDonald in the election next Tuesday," I think we always hold our elections on Tuesdays, "then I promise you the full faith of the Soviet Union that we will, with Mr. MacDonald's help, forge England into a Bolshevik paradise. We'll abolish the king and queen, the aristocracy will go, great houses will be taken over. It'll be just like Peking and Shanghai." And this was a 10-column headline in the Daily Mail of what would happen if Ramsay MacDonald was returned to power. And the result was what you'd imagine, an overwhelming defeat for Ramsay MacDonald, because people said, "By God, this cannot happen to the United Kingdom. We're not going to have the Soviet Britain." And Stanley Baldwin got a huge majority and was prime minister for the next many, many years. But the Zinoviev letter was a forgery. It was produced by an agent of MI5 working in the Foreign Office, and with the full complicity of the Daily Mail, which was a rabble-rousing right-wing newspaper. Overnight, the election turned and Ramsay MacDonald was defeated. So fake news is not a phenomenon of Tucker Carlson and Don Lemon, but is a feature which has been a cancer on the spread of information for a long, long time. So I talk then about, and I really must keep an eye on the clock, but I find this such a fascinating topic. I talk about public relations. I don't know if you've heard of a man called Edward Bernays, a remarkable man who was a cousin of Freud's, lived in New York. He essentially created the science, if you can call it that, of public relations, and it was a master manipulating the public mind. A very good example is that in the, I think, late 1920s, he was approached by the Beechnut company, which, if you know it at all, you think of it as producing chewing gum. But in those days, it was actually the principal company for the making of ham, processing of pigs and hogs and things. And they complained that Americans were eating cornflakes and granola and things like that at breakfast, and they ought to be consuming ham. Could you help us, Mr. Bernays? And so Bernays thought about it and found a tame doctor in New York who said, yes, did you know that when you're asleep, you lose protein? And so it's very important that when you wake up, the first thing you do is consume lots of protein, as in bacon and eggs. And this Bernays then circulated this entirely bogus piece of research to 5,000 doctors around the United States, who all said, well, if X in New York says it, must be true. And so a piece appeared in the New York Times sometime in late 1928, I think it was, saying scientists conclude bacon and eggs is far better for you in the morning than cornflakes. And almost overnight, the bacon and egg breakfast was born and has essentially been with us ever since, all to do with PR, mind manipulation, and so forth. And so towards the end of this, and I talk about the devices that we have made to stop us using our brains. So this is another way in which information is transmitted and massaged and manipulated. The first such device was in 1967. It was made by Texas Instruments by a man with the lovely name of Jerry Merriman. I think only in America would you find a man called Jerry Merriman. And he produced the first electronic calculator. And up to that point, even if we used the abacus or the slide rule, you had to have some sort of fair knowledge of mathematical processes to know how to work them. But with this device, which fit just in your shirt pocket, you simply press buttons, numbers, and add or subtract. They added, multiply, and divide later. And for $400, you could get this device, which would unerringly come up with the answer to any addition or subtraction puzzle you put to it, but crucially, totally invisibly. So you never knew what was going on inside it. And this enabled us, at first somewhat cautiously, but eventually almost wholly, to the part of our brain that deals with basic arithmetic. We just lost it. We just put it into cold storage. And so various other things were reduced like this, our ability to spell, to know where we are on the surface of the planet, to when GPS came along, you no longer needed to know how to get to Aunt Agatha in Dubuque or to sail from Papeete to Panama. GPS did it for us. And then came Wikipedia, which presented this cornucopia of knowledge, and then Google, probably the most significant of all recent inventions, until AI, of course. Any question you wanted was available at the touch of a button. And thereby, all these various parts of our brains were put into cold storage, put on ice, no longer needed. And that's when the doomsayers came along and said, well, this is terrible, because if we're stopping using our brains, well, what has happened to, and I'm looking at this audience today, I can't charge any of you with this, but look what labor-saving devices have done in the last 150 years. Mr. Otis made his elevator. People no longer climbed upstairs. You know, they use vacuum cleaners and electric toothbrushes and things. And if you, I don't know, a film like Wall-E, I don't know if many of you have seen this, I think a terribly important film, which shows what ultimately happens. And if you go into a shopping mall in, I don't know, in South Dakota or somewhere, you would see people that clearly don't use their bodies nearly as much as they should. And in Wall-E, I've tried to be as polite as I possibly can, you see them all, they've utterly polluted the planet. And so they live in sort of capsules in suborbital flight on huge lazy boy chairs, being fed like milch cows with a sort of nutritious substance from squeeze bottles and just watching... there we are. watching soft porn and commercials on flat-screen televisions. Is that kind of thing going to happen to our brains? Are they going to decay or fall into... we'll just lose our ability to use them. Well, this is where I go back to remembering Plato and Socrates and people like that. I have come to the conclusion that actually all these inventions, and I'm saving AI for it's a different discussion, although I talk about it in the book at length. But, okay, you can use Google, leaving the arithmetic and the spelling and so forth. If you want to know the capital of South Dakota, if you want to know the atomic weight of sodium or magnesium, if you want to know the principal architects of the Enlightenment or the signatories of the revolution here, constitution and so forth, you can find it easily. You don't have to know it. And people therefore say, well, if you don't have to know it, you'll stop knowing. You'll stop being curious about things. I would say I take an optimistic view of this by saying as follows, that I think there's probably no qualitative difference between the intelligence of people like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and Euclid and Pythagoras and Herodotus than the cleverest among them us today. I think Bertrand Russell, Hannah Arendt and people like that, every bit qualitatively as intelligent as those people. But the advantage that those people had is that they didn't have to know very much. I mean, they only had to essentially know one language. Maybe Aristotle, who did travel, the others did not travel, might have come to know a little bit of Arabic. They had very little history to know because there wasn't that much history before them. They certainly didn't have to know the capital of South Dakota. They didn't have to know the atomic weight of sodium. Their brains were, each one was a tabula rasa, if you like, able to think great thoughts, like what are ethics? Socrates pondered that. What is knowledge? As I've explained, Plato sort of tried to determine. And then Aristotle, what, you know, the concept of eudaimonia, happiness derived from doing the right thing. I mean, wisdom and all that kind of stuff. What if we, freed from this need, which we feel an obligation to know the capital of South Dakota? I'm sorry to keep bringing South, I hope there are no South Dakotans here. I don't mean to offend them. It's a strange capital, strange pronunciation, Pierre, but pronounced Pierre. But also the atomic weight of sodium. I mean, all of this is unnecessary. Purists may be horrified at hearing this, but I look upon these new inventions as being like holding your brain under a faucet of cold water and giving it a good cleansing of all the stickiness and reducing us, our wise people, our clever people, into the same state of cleansed, purged, tabulae rasa, if that is the plural, able, therefore, to think great thoughts, uncluttered. So it is my optimistic, my hope rather than my belief. And that is a whole other subject, the difference between belief and knowledge, which we can maybe get to in the Q&A session. But it's possible, I think, that maybe, thanks to these new electronic devices, there will be a 21st century Plato and a 21st century Aristotle, and the world will then become a somewhat better place because we will start to think about the things, not the things we feel we ought to we're bound to know, but what we really ought to know in order to be fully human. So whether wisdom comes from that, I'm not sure. I hope so. I want to sort of end on this book was put to bed essentially a little after Christmas. And I had already been told about GPT-3 and GPT-3.5, but I had to do quite a lot of amendment of what it could do. And then, of course, we've now got GPT-4.0, which is stellar. But let me just read you something that what GPT could do, and I managed to include in the book. I gave it to a friend of mine in San Francisco, and one of my favorite poems, and I dare say it's probably yours, is Shelley's Ozymandias, the poem, sonnet, I think, that begins, "I met a traveler from an antique land who said two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert beside them." That's all I gave to GPT, and you will remember, I can think just about recite the whole thing, and of course the famous line in it is, and on the pedestal these words appear, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Well, GPT 3.5 didn't come up with that, but it came up with this. So, in other words, who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, near them on the sand, there are many tracks, and in the distance and all alone, I saw far below me what I thought was the sea, but they are the tracks of man, which never die, and I have no power to turn them to account. The road I took, I know well. The journey took me in vain. The course I took to get here and back again, and here again forevermore. I look up at the sea and I say to myself, there are no other lands, there is no other time, there are no other souls. Now that was written by a computer, and I don't know, I think that pretty beautiful. It has an error which a human can discern. It's not possible to look up at the sea. You can look down at the sea, you can look across at the sea, but you can never look up at the sea. At least I don't think you can. But apart from that single error, the thing is lyrical. So we then said to it, well, take a paragraph of Winchester's book. And so they took a paragraph, and we put the result into a little illustrative box, and it's here on page 314. And it is pretty terrifying, such that when Sarah Nelson, my editor, read it, she said, you know, whether I'll commission you to write your next book, I may be calling on the services of GPT-5, or who knows. But anyway, the fact that it can achieve beauty, the fact that it may yet become sentient, the fact that it may say, as Hal said to Dave in the ship in 2001, it may not allow itself to be unplugged. That's terrifying. And may nudge us back towards belief systems rather than knowledge systems. So that effectively is what the book is all about. Optimism, generally, that we may produce our own Plato if we get rid of the stuff we don't need to know, but nonetheless abject terror that I may not have a job, thanks to AI, and all of you too. So please, on with the questions if there are any, but thank you very much indeed.
With this idea that ChatGPT's possibility could nudge us towards beliefs instead of knowledge. I think that's what I heard. Could you clarify?
Yes, I haven't put any of this in the book. It's what I'm beginning to think about. Until the Enlightenment, of course, belief essentially was knowledge, and you know what happened to people that challenged that, Galileo being a classic example. And there was the famous chap, the Bishop of Armagh, and he'd added up all the begattings and begottens and so forth in the Bible and determined that it is evident that the earth, at least according to the Old Testament, was created in 4004 BC on October the 29th. And then a man who was clearly no fool either, because he went on, this other fellow, to become vice-chancellor of Cambridge University, so he was clearly regarded by some as being bright, worked it out with even more refinement and said it was indeed the 29th of October, 4004 BC, at 9 a.m. So just after the Lord finished his breakfast, he said, well, let's create the world or everything. That, to us, sounds fanciful, but it was, if you look at an 18th century copy of the Bible, you'll see Genesis 1, and written in the normal black type of a Bible, you know, in the beginning, God, but next to it in rubric, 4004 BC, October 29th. So that was regarded as fact. That was transformed from belief into knowledge by the authority of a well-respected divine. Well, that all began to unpack itself, of course, when the rationalists, the Voltaires and the Rousseaus and so forth, came into, and science became a thing that was believed. But I think my problem nowadays is that so much of what we believe or are told is fact, we're no longer as certain as we were. Maybe it was not right for us to be certain, but okay, put it crudely, belief is merely belief. You have to have faith to accept it as doctrine or dogma. Science produces evidence-based, or you are told, it offers up evidence-based knowledge. In other words, the J of the justified true belief. But what if what is in my right hand becomes more and more distrusted? Some people, and I think it is happening already were saying, well, belief has been around for thousands of years and is essentially unchanged. I mean, we still use, at least here, a calendar based on the birth of Christ. I mean, this is 2023 Anno Domini, which in its, you know, there's no logical reason for that number other than it's rooted in an ancient belief. And some people, I think a growing number of people, as AI begins to take over and further erodes our trust, our confidence in what we've come to believe as knowledge, some, and we may deride them as, you know, suggestible people, may say, well, perhaps belief is a better thing, perhaps faith is better, perhaps the scientists and the newspaper proprietors and the dictionary and encyclopedia editors are as fallible as popes and cardinals and authorities in the church. I don't know, but I suspect that's probably what's going to happen for a while, which is bad news, I think, if suddenly, well, I don't want to get too deeply into it because I'm not quite sure of the audience and I may get howled at. But I think in general, belief may achieve the same status or achieve a growing credibility as knowledge loses credibility. No, I think it's a dreadful thing. No, I'm... Oh, no, I am, believe you me, I'm an ultra-rationalist. I mean, I'm a child of the Enlightenment. But thank you for your question, because I think it's completely fascinating what's likely to happen.
Thank you for your talk. It's very excellent. I really appreciate such an interesting conversation. What my question is to you is that it's not any kind of contemporary fact that a lie travels around the world while, you know, a truth is putting on its shoes. That's an old quote. But obviously the amount of the volume of lies that go on and the amount of false information is scary. I want to see how that squares with your optimism for...
Yes, yeah. Well, I don't have a television. And it doesn't mean I can't watch Succession, which I'm... But I do think the media generally is... There are certain countries where the media is respectable and consequently respected and is still to be trusted. I think the BBC is still pretty good. I think the BBC World Service, which everyone here will now, thanks to the computer, you can listen to any radio station anywhere. But I'm afraid, I mean, once again, if I'm critical of the American media, I am as a friend and not as some sort of... And one of you, I mean, I read the New York Times every day, but it troubles me. And the coverage, for instance, of the election and the candidates, I mean, I think DeSantis is being given far too much airtime. I think Trump is being given far too much airtime. Just forget him if you can. I mean, he can talk to through his Truth Social or whatever it's called, but do we need front page pieces in the Times day after day after day? I don't think we do. I mean, yes, it's obviously I believe in freedom of speech and freedom of information and freedom of the press. But I think those who, the editors, the day-to-day editors, should exercise a bit more prudence, realizing that even bad publicity for a person like Trump is giving him the airtime that he desperately needs. And I hope I'm preaching to the converted here. I would just like him to go away. Things could get better because people, particularly the commercial television and radio stations who want, because of their advertisers, they need ratings. And so this comes back to the whole of the commodification of news, the commodification of knowledge. Is knowledge a commodity to be bought and sold, like healthcare? I mean, there are systemic problems in particularly this society. And that helps spread the lie around the world while, as you say, truth is putting on its shoes. So, it's troublesome. I don't know what to do except get some of these editors to be a bit more responsible than they have been and don't just chase ratings all the time.
So what is the future of thinking?
Huh. Well, I was talking about this last night because I was in Cambridge at Harvard, like this, a very nice and engaged audience. And I was saying that I remember, I don't know why I said it, but I'd been watching that old black and white film version of 39 Steps. And if you remember Richard Hannay on the run after being suspected of murdering that lady in London, stumbled into in a small village hall somewhere in the Scottish Highlands into a public debate. And it was clearly an energetic and everyone was, in a highly intelligent way, arguing and debating with each other. The whole question, I think, of public discourse, I would love to see it revived. I live in a very small village in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts, and I was elected town moderator. So I'm actually an elected official now that I'm an American citizen. And we have an arts center, and what I want to, and I haven't done it, but I intend to do it this year, bring people together just to have a debate about the issues of the times and come up with, you know, obviously the obvious issues like right to life or, well, you can name 1,001 issues, but get people talking, not just passively, like the people in suborbital flight in Wall-E, receiving information, engage in it, debate it, think about it. So I think it is possible to re-energize people, and I would like to see that happening. So it takes a village. So I think someone in the White House once said that. And if we can start it in Western Massachusetts, well, who knows? And it's interesting to note, I also, with my wife, we started a newspaper in this little town called Sandysfield. And if you go to sandysfieldtimes.org, you can see it. It's free, but it's, whereas newspapers are all over the world and all over the country are dying, we're hugely expanding. And we've now existed for, this is our 15th year. And we're very proud. So there is an undercurrent, a yearning, I think, for debate and intelligent offering. And there's, we take no political point of view. We present knowledge about the town. The last thing I did before I left on this tour, I did 600 words about some road closure. I mean, you'd think it's maybe mundane, but roads in rural America, very important. And this was quite an important development, and it was an exclusive story. It was a little scoop. And so that kind of thing should be encouraged, I think.
So my question has to do with the sequel to your book on knowledge. Have you contemplated writing about wisdom, and how would that differ from the book you've just written?
Well, actually, chapter 6 is all about wisdom. I just didn't get into it because of this wretched thing and because of beasts. Like, but I mean, I can honestly, there's this outfit in the University of Chicago called the Center for Practical Wisdom, which is, they're doing research on what is wisdom. I mean, conventionally, what do you think? Wisdom is a multiplying knowledge by time, so experience. So if you're someone who's frightfully old and knows a lot of things, he or she has the potential to be wise. Why it tends, therefore, that wisdom tends to be thought of as something more common in older people than in among the TikTok generation, if you like. And I think that's probably true, but the people at the center in Chicago believe that wisdom, which is, after all, effectively having right thoughts, common sense, but sort of common sense on steroids, it can actually be taught. And so they're doing... I urge you to go to the website, the Center for Practical Wisdom at the University of Chicago, a man called Howard Nussbaum, who's doing fascinating research. But I look at a lot of polymaths. I'm very interested in the idea of polymathy. And were polymaths necessarily wise? I mean, I've used the example, I think I choose 6 or 7, like many who know about him, Ramanujan, the Bengali mathematician, who only lived until he was 36 or something. Phenomenally clever, self-taught mathematician. And you probably know the story. When he was effectively on his deathbed in Cambridge in England, dying of, I think, TB, G.H. Hardy, who was his great friend and mentor, who was a professor of mathematics at Cambridge, came to see him. And Ramanujan, on his bed, said, "Oh, Hardy, did you by any chance notice the number of the taxi that you came in?" And Hardy, being a mathematician, noticed numbers, and he said, "Oh, it was a completely unimportant number, 1729. And Ramanujan said, "That's a very important number. It is the lowest number which can be created by the addition of two things multiplied and squared, after being squared, it's whatever. Anyway, two times. So it's a cubed. So one cubed plus 12 cubed 12 by 12 by 12 is 1728. 1 times 1 times 1 is 1. So that's 1729. But it can be done another way. 10 cubed and something like 42 cubed becomes 1729. So there are what are known in mathematics as taxi numbers, T1. That's T1. And for Rabinowitz just to have realized that while lying on his deathbed marks him out as being an astonishingly intelligent man with a very, very nimble... But was he wise? No, he was a complete dunderhead. He couldn't find his way across Cambridge. So intelligence and wisdom are two different things. And I know I'm reasonably intelligent, but I do know I've not a hope of ever being wise. But thank you for your question anyway. Well, thank you all very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.